Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Many of you have written to ask us why BJ Novak keeps getting bumped. Well, we've had guests run long, he had a bad reaction to some green room canapes, and his monkey attacked an intern. He's had a run of bad luck, but today it's going to end. Stay tuned. BJ Novak is here. He will be on today's show. Joining me are my co-hosts. He's an author, a professor at UC Riverside, an award-winning beekeeper. One of those things is not true. LARB founding editor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Vitayu. That is, by the way, Belarusian.
How do you know Belarusian?
Well, it's our new Nobel laureate in
literature. Her name is?
Svetlana Alexievich.
You pronounced that very well. Also with us, our other co-conspirator. She's written for the New York Times, the LA Times. She's written the graffiti on the ladies' room wall at Musso and Frank's, the one that says, "For a good time, call Joyce Carol Oates." One of those things is not true. She's the fiction editor of LARB, Lori Weiner.
Bonjour.
Bruce Bauman is the senior editor of the literary journal Black Clock. He teaches at CalArts, and he has a new novel out. It's called Broken Sleep, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks for having me. I'm welcoming you guys, too.
Oh, thank you.
Publishing Inside Baseball, your publisher's Other Press, they're releasing this book with three different colors. What's that about? Three different versions of the book, all with different colors, I should say.
I think everybody loved the cover. It makes reference to Salome, the character who is the artist. And I just did Litquake, and they had all three together, and it looked really terrific. I was really happy.
It's like you wrote three books.
I felt like I wrote three or 12, maybe.
Thoreau, at one point, one of his books didn't sell. The publisher gave him back all the unsold copies and the plates. And he said, "I am now the proud owner of a library of 427 books, 423 of which I have written myself." Yeah. And so if you end up with 423 copies, it'll look like you've got just 100 copies of three
prolific
books.
So, Bruce, the book is called Broken Sleep, and it's a kaleidoscope. And you do a deep dive into the New York art world and a very deep dive into the rock and roll world. And rock and roll has been a big cultural factor in the world for 60 years or so at this point. And yet it's not been a subject of much fiction. Why do you think that is? I would describe this is a rock and roll novel, you could say.
Well, it's been more lately, but I think it's really hard to write about music in a way that people can hear music, because you hear it and it affects all of your senses. And there's a great essay by William Gass called The Music of Prose, and where he says writing can't be music, because it can't, but as a writer, you should make music. And this is egomaniacal, but I tried to get this book to have a sound and to sound like rock and roll. I think Hunter Thompson is one of the few writers I know who writes rock and roll. You read his phrases, and they're rock and roll, the way Kerouac was, 50s jazz, and Fitzgerald was 20s jazz.
Yeah, isn't it partly that it's the dancing about architecture, that what you're writing? I did have this moment where my first book was about a disease that was neurasthenia, which was called blues. I tried to write about blues, and I'm a blues player, and I thought I'm going to be the guy that's going to write about blues in a way different than everybody else, because I know blues, I play blues. And I wrote it, and it was exactly like everything else I'd ever written academically. It was no better, probably no worse, but
everything in this book has to do with my obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a big believer in not writing what you know, but writing your obsessions, and a lot what you don't know. There's an immense amount in here that I didn't know when I started. I mean, it took me 20 years to write this book, realistically. I started a few times, realized I didn't know enough to do it. I wasn't smart enough emotionally or intellectually, and I didn't have the stamina. So when I finally did it, I had something like 20 notebooks.
You actually started writing the book in the 90s, and you stopped because it wasn't working. And frankly, I don't know how you ever got it to work, because this book is so complexly structured. But what was the wall that you hit, and what clicked that helped you unlock the problem you were having?
Okay. I want to go back to And the Word Was Too, because which is my first novel. I had the ideas for both of them and a third novel, which I have not yet written, really when I was in my 20s. I had this basic germ for all of these books in some way. I couldn't do any of them. And I tried first And the Word Was. At the beginning, that was just a story about Neil Downs and his kid dying. And I had a short story about the philosopher Levi Furstenbaum. And then I went to India and suddenly it just hit me and I have no idea how it does. They belong together. And suddenly the book went like this. With this book, I actually had the idea of the Insatiables and I had the idea.
We should say the Insatiables is the band in Broken Sleep.
Right. And I had an idea about taking the Moses myth and turning on its head, where in the Bible, Moses is born a Jew and is raised by an Egyptian. I wanted to have Moses who was raised as a Jew, but was, should we say, something else. I don't know how much I want to give away. Mm-hmm. And turning it on its head and being, you know, abandoned by his family. And when I first started, it was just about the Insatiables and some politics and some other stuff that is not in there. And then Salome kind of evolved in my head. And then I said, this is how it works.
When you have an epiphany like that about structure, do you ever lose it?
All the time. Like, this is working yesterday. Yeah.
My name is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. So, Bruce, speaking of structure, there's a picture I ran across. I think it's on your website when I was doing my deep dive this morning. And it's you in a room, and every surface is covered with pages. You look like Carrie Matheson from Homeland. Everything is arrayed around. You look like you're insane in this art installation.
Little threads going from
yeah, and other than I wanted
there's
to call...
There's a picture of Mandy Patinkin for some reason.
I wanted to call 911 when I saw the picture.
I mean, I started putting stuff on the wall years ago when I was doing And the Word Was, because there were two strands. And I started doing that when I was at the Writers Colony in Virginia, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, because when I started, I was actually still living in New York, and my apartment was about the size of this room, which is like...
Which is enormous and very large and very beautiful studio.
Right. Don't want to stretch out your arms too much.
We're in a storage closet, to right. be clear to our listeners.
Okay, right. So I like walking in to the... It's like I'm walking into this world I created. But at different times, I would just have the Moses characters, you know, strain on the wall. Sometimes Salome would be here. Sometimes, you know, if it was just a small one, if it was just Hannah, which is a few pages. And then as the book goes on, I have it on the floor, each chapter, and I start to construct.
There's a list of characters in the back matter, right? There's a lot of back matter, and I want to talk about some of it.
Sure.
But one of them is a list of all the characters fit to print, the major characters, primary characters, the secondary characters, and each gets a birth date. So was that on the wall?
Yes. No, that at the beginning, no, because I kind of knew when the main guys were. And as each new character came up, yeah, then I had to like say, okay.
And the other, one of the other parts of the back matter are your credits, mm-hmm. right? Where you take, for instance, page 58, that week I was dying too. And you tell us that's from Grace Paley's story, Living, in 1974. And I found it interesting because it's a very short phrase, and some of them are even shorter than that. Foul Dust, mm-hmm. right? And you have a credit to The Great Gatsby for Foul Dust. And why did you want to have that?
Okay, the genesis of that comes from J.D. Salinger's story, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, where in the story he makes reference to, and now I'm forgetting, memory. I use it in here, mm-hmm. But it's from T.S. Eliot.
Right.
So he's referencing that, which is also a reference way back to Satyricon.
Right.
But then later in the book, the Seymour character tells Muriel, or Muriel is talking to her mother and says, you know, did you read that book of German poetry? And she says, no, it's in German. And the mother goes, you don't read German. And Seymour has told her he's the greatest poet of the last century, and he's referencing Rilke. So in that story, he referenced Rilke and Eliot. And I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. And so when I started doing this, I said, well, I want to do that too. And it just expanded. I mean, at one point I had another 25 or 30 of these, and they didn't fit. So I was pushing them into sentences as opposed to them just being part of the sentences. Mm-hmm. And then the question came, do we put something in the back or do we not? And it was really a long, tortured debate with myself and then with my editors. In the end, I said yes, because there are too many. There's some that are famous, and one, I don't want people to think that I'm like plagiarizing and don't know what the hell I'm doing. and there are a lot that are obscure. So why the hell not, you know? And then maybe, and this isn't my role, but I still think of myself as a writing instructor. People will read that and go read those books, because people aren't reading a lot of those books that I mentioned in there.
Yeah. Also, it's a literary conceit, and it's a very literary book.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, just if I can nerd out on this for a minute.
Sure.
David Shields writes in Reality Hunger Manifesto, and it's 90% quotation. And one of the things he fought with his publisher about was leaving out where all of the quotes came from, right? And part of his argument is, this is the way writing happens. We're all kind of hearing phrases, listening to other writers, and all of that becomes part of the way we talk, whether it's a direct quotation or a paraphrase or a series of words that we only know because we read writer X or Y or Z. And therefore, it's what we all do. And it's a necessary intertextuality, it's called, right?
Right.
And so in this case, I like the pedagogical impulse. That is, you want people to think about these books. But in other ways, there are probably hundreds of other examples that one could find in here.
So many of the chapter titles. Mm-hmm. At one point, I had a list of, like, you know, where they all came from. Like, my favorite is Maybe We Ain't Us, which is from The Little Rascals.
Uh-huh.
It's Scotty. And yeah. So, yeah, there's so many more.
One of the more philosophical shows from our childhood.
My point, standpoint as well. And the downside is, well, somebody's going to go, the schmuck, he's showing off, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, if you think that, yeah, I am. Anyway, no, I mean, it's just what it is. I love literature. I love books. Books save my damn life. And these are the books that save my life. So why not give them credit, you know?
One last question before you go.
Sure.
Didn't anybody tell you shouldn't write 600-page novels?
Everybody.
That's what I'm assuming.
Believe me. The last story, I got my contract after I signed it, and it said 100,000 words.
Uh-huh.
I crossed it out. Or 200,000, I initialed it. They initialed it, but then nobody paid attention. And then when I handed it in, they go, what the hell is this? I said, look at the contract.
All right, the book is Broken Sleep by Bruce Bauman, who's been our guest today. Thanks for coming in.
Sure.
The author Parnaz Furutan has been gracious enough to come back to talk to us about a book she thinks we should be reading. Parnaz, what's this book?
It's a work of nonfiction by Dr. Janet Afari. It's called The Constitutional Revolution of Iran. And the Constitutional Revolution was a period in 1906 when the people decided that they were tired of being sort of pushed around by the Qajar dynasty, and they were tired of the Qajar dynasty being the puppets of Britain and Russia. And so there was this uprising, this democratic uprising of the people. And it was all sorts of people. And they were talking about wonderful things. They were talking about the education of women. They were talking about all religious minorities having a voice in parliament. And they were talking about land reform. And this period was just this magnificent flowering of the spirit and this movement. And then it was just demolished by Russia and Britain. And I think right now we're in the aftermath of that. So I think if anyone really wants to get a good, solid understanding of what's going on in the political sphere of Iran, this would be a good place to start.
Sounds great.
Now, do you go back to Iran?
I did go back in my 20s. I lived there for a while. I worked as an English teacher, and I was actually a performance artist with a punk jazz band.
Uh-huh. And where that was in Tehran?
That was in Tehran. There was it was very underground because everything has to be very underground. So yeah.
And have you been back recently?
I'm now the mother of two little girls, so I can't be as much of a daredevil as I used to be.
But I'm sure your girls love the punk band.
The girls will never hear that.
We have footage and they
nobody has footage.
Okay, we just skipped over. I was a performance artist in front of a punk jazz band. You're not leaving the studio without telling us what your act was.
I would scream poetry into a microphone. That was my act.
Beautiful.
Would you like to do a little bit of it for us right now?
No.
Just thought I'd ask.
And the minute I get home, I'm burning whatever footage remains.
And you want to do one more?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
What's the book?
City by Alessandro Baricchio. It's a magnificent book. I think he's probably one of the greatest living authors of our time. And I keep telling people, God, have you guys heard of this guy? And not many of us have. He's magnificent.
What's the book about?
It follows this young boy. He's a genius. And the way he does it, there's something very Faulkner about Baricchio. He has absolutely very, very little regard for how well the reader can follow the point of view and its shifts. Mm. And he goes into the boy's head, into his imagination, and comes out with such grace. He's a master. I'm really in awe of his writing.
Parnas Forutan, thank you for telling us about Alessandro Baricchio and Iran's constitutional revolution. Thank you for coming back to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
My name is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Our intern and czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, is sitting in on this segment. Welcome, Aviva.
Thanks for having me.
So the reason we're having you on is because of this huge controversy that's going on at Yale right now. Were you familiar with this thing at Yale?
Mm-hmm.
The Intercultural Affairs Committee sent an email urging students to consider the relative offensiveness of their costumes. And one of the people who serve as housemasters at one of the residential colleges of Yale University took exception to this and sent out her own email. And this email said, essentially, haven't we gone a little too far in policing what students should wear? And shouldn't this be left up to students? And isn't a university meant as a place where people discuss and debate and sort it out themselves?
The way I read the Yale controversy, it was that the woman who wrote the second email did so in order to say not just that it's okay to wear whatever you want. She said, I think that in over-regulating, because the original email about offensive costumes was linked to Pinterest sites where they showed bad costumes and good costumes, and you know it seemed to her to be an over-regulation, and she said Halloween and college campuses used to be places where you stepped over boundaries.
You transgressed.
You transgressed. And transgression is an important part of education. It's an important part of building the new society that you want to be in. And all transgressions are not created equally. And we should be able to talk about transgression, not just outlaw it.
Exactly. That's precisely what she said. And then subsequently, her husband, with whom she is the co-head of this residential college at Yale, sent out an email in her defense. At that point, all hell broke loose. People were calling for their resignations. The accusation was they were not creating a safe space at the college. And we're going to listen to a confrontation right now that occurred on campus between a student at Yale and this guy who is the co-head with his wife of this residential college at Yale University.
As your position as master, it is your job to create a place of comfort and home for the students that live in Silliman. You have not done that. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that?
Then no, I stop. Don't agree with that.
Then why the fuck did you accept the position?
Because
who
I have
the fuck hired you?
I have a different vision.
You should step down. If that is what you think about being a master, you should step down. It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here.
Now, Aviva, you're a senior at Pitzer. Is Pitzer a safe space?
It's one of the most liberal colleges in the state. So I would say, according to the traditional definition, it's a fairly safe space, although we still have conversations like this a lot. I think in terms of the student who was just yelling at the, I don't know his name.
The master.
At the master. That's not the way I would convey that message. But at the same time, I think that we need to believe that people are the experts of their own experiences. And I think that if someone says that something is offensive or triggering, we need to believe them. And that, in my opinion, isn't even up for debate. It's not a useful conversation to say like it is or it isn't, because we just have to believe people.
The trigger, of course, is the bigger topic of the day, right? This Halloween fracas is part of that same thing. They're arguing that any of these offensive costumes could be a trigger and therefore should not be allowed. I have now a standard warning on all my syllabi that just says, this is a course in literature, or this is a writing course, and literary writing is, by its very nature, designed to do lots of things, including making people uncomfortable, including discussing all that it means to be human. And if there's anything that about being human that might disturb you, you should take another course.
I took a course last semester called Black Feminisms and Social Change with my professor was a former Black Panther. And at the beginning of the course, the first day, she said, this course, I know you college students these days love your trigger warning. So here it is. This whole class should be a trigger. And if it's not, there's something wrong with you, mm-hmm. which I thought was really effective.
But going back to the video that we listened to, the woman said something and then the professor said, well, I don't agree with you. And then she completely lost her shit, right? And all he said was, I don't agree with you.
Right.
And so she's basically saying, no, you're not allowed to not agree with me on this issue.
Again, like maybe she didn't do it in the best way, but at the same time, I think that students of color are often forced to educate their white and middle upper class peers. And I don't think that they shouldn't have to shoulder that responsibility. I think that it's the job of the college and the campus to create a space and create spaces for dialogue where people can engage, because it is important.
I mean, I'm just saying, I wonder if what the students are expecting or requesting is actually something that's very unreal and very unlikely to ever happen, which is that they never feel unsafe ever, even in a discussion or an argument.
What is a safe space as you understand it? What does that mean?
Well, it's kind of hard because from my understanding, a safe space is like specifically geared towards historically underrepresented students. But at the same time, I don't think that you should deny that safe space should be really all inclusive. And oftentimes I feel that the safe space for more privileged students is sacrificed in turn for like less privileged students. And I think that the policing of language sort of strangles any sort of useful dialogue at this point, because everyone's so afraid to say anything, and colleges ultimately are a place to learn. And when you're learning new concepts and ideas, you're going to stumble through what you're saying.
You know, the whole idea of a safe space is the idea that there's a possible space which is going to be so perfectly regulated that nobody will ever be offended. And I'm suggesting that's a frank impossibility, right?
Right, I agree.
I had a student in one of my classes who was very upset about the way she felt she was being treated by another student. And it turned out that was rolling her eyes when this woman would say something. Is there a way in which we can outlaw the eye roll? Is there a way we can outlaw every sigh that anybody might have? And is that a world that we want, where you're not allowed to ever express your distaste for something else that somebody's saying?
I think the difference between an eye roll and, you know, like a tiki torch and hula skirt for Halloween is a historical context.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But the real issue, it seems to me, is the eye roll. That is the microaggression, the tiki skirt is not a microaggression. That's at this point a macroaggression, right?
When something like what occurred at Yale happens, do you think there's, and I'm referring to what the dean said, the email that initiated the whole thing, does an infantilization occur? Does that concern you at all? Does it
like
put,
of the students yeah, and the shift of the power
exactly
from the
right.
students to the
exactly right because it's as if Zeus is sending a thunderbolt down, leaving the students essentially to go out into the world, never having to have done those things by themselves for themselves, and isn't ultimately that really what college is meant to do? Prepare students for what the world is like, and the world is not a safe space.
Right. I do feel uncomfortable with that shift of authority from the students to the administration, but at the same time, the way. Like reading the email from the woman, from the master, I thought that she sort of implied that if we censored what the students could wear, it would be the only form. Like, why are we imposing this censorship now on these students as if there aren't already very real forms of censorship that are just less overt?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and listening to that audio that we listened to, the girl is in pain. You do feel for the girl. There's real pain there. But also, she's projecting something from some other situation onto this professor because, you know, he said in a very respectful way, I don't agree. And one of the things you do have to learn when you're that age and you're so full of emotion and you're learning how to argue is when how to argue properly, how to modulate emotion, how to respond to what's actually being said instead of something that's in swirling around inside your head. And I think that for this young woman, there was an issue about reality and what was going on inside of her head.
Right. I feel like that's true, and I don't condone the way that she conveyed her message, but at the same time, it's really easy to paint her as like crazy and volatile and violent when really she's living in a society with these very violent interlocking systems of domination that go unacknowledged. And so, like, I just imagine, you know, if someone's like flicks you every single day and no one sees it, and then one time someone flicks you and everyone sees it, it's really, and then you freak out because it's happened every day of your life. It's really easy to have everyone be like, he just flicked you. It's like not that big of a deal. Mm. But no one sees like the 21 or, you know, however old she is, years of unacknowledged flicks.
Okay.
All right, Aviva, thanks for talking to us about
thanks
this.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to Bruce Bauman, Parnaz Furutan. Apologies to BJ Novak. Once again, we ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. Our thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Orellano, czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, who ably stepped up to the mic to discuss trigger warnings and safe spaces in university life in America today and did a terrific job. She's also recovering nicely from being bitten by BJ Novak's monkey, and we're all happy to see that. And of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs. We couldn't do this show without the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. Every week, we are grateful to them. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is very good. Write a review if you feel like it. Something that begins with, how do I love the LARB Radio Hour? Let me count the ways. You can fill out the rest. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening. See you next week.